this thing on?
I hope so. Because that'd be weird if I was just hearing you in my head.
You don't hear me in your head on a regular basis?
No, no.
Hmm.
Fortunately, for lots of reasons I can think of.
I don't get to be the sound of your conscience like one of the little angels or demons that sits on your shoulder and tells you what to do?
Well, I don't... Which would you be exactly?
That's a good question. I have no idea.
See, exactly.
I suppose it's all subjective based on your general line in the sand with regards to morals and what have you.
Well, if it was like Inside Out, then maybe you would be like indecision or something like that. And you'd just be sort of like a gray spheroid lump and you'd just sit there and go, I don't know.
I'd be pretty good at that. Yeah. Or the voice in the back of your head that just says, you should take a nap. Let's order a pizza.
So that's a ringing endorsement for us as people talking about things, I guess. How's your week so far?
Oh, it's just fine. What day is it? Today's Wednesday, right?
Yes. It's the middle of the week. Some camels might refer to it as hump day.
Yeah. My week has been mostly filled with completing tedious paperwork and trying to sync several thousand files via Dropbox for the past, 7 days.
That sounds really exciting.
Yeah, yeah. My internet connection is apparently not very fast.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You should be.
Yes. Well, I mean, obviously I sabotaged your internet connection because I'm nefarious like that.
You want to make it difficult to talk over the internet.
Yes. It's all about bringing down this podcast and ruining it before we can hit a full year.
Yeah. Speaking of weeks and your conversations via podcasts, you had a thing come out last week.
Yeah. It was sort of like a soft launch of just testing the waters. A couple of, public observations. It's a general little tech show thing. It's not super long. First one was only 35 minutes. And I'm talking with Marco Savic, who might be familiar to some people as sort of like a marketing person. But we don't really talk about his job or my job. We're talking about the Apple TV, of course, which, you and I talk about. And he had some counterpoints to kind of the things that you and I typically agree on. So it was good to have another perspective. Although we are hoping to get Marco a microphone in the future. Because I don't know if you can notice, but that audio quality it's not great. It's not as bad as if it was like a tin can stretched between here and Ontario, but might as well be. but we're working on that.
Spare? So send him one.
No, I think he arranged it via this thing they have up there called Amazon. But
wait, Amazon.ca. What's the address? That was a callback.
Yes. Yes.
Way back to episode, what was it? Seven?
Seven with Mike Hurley when we talked about Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yeah.
That was a good one.
And it was a good episode. Talked a lot about Amazon and, technology and, ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. And throwing keys at, his head.
Oh, that's a good movie. We should talk about that movie.
Mm-hmm. Vegan police. Freeze. No, but... speaking of, that reminds me. Do you know what I'm having right now? My beverage today?
Oh, no. What did you do?
It's a callback. As well.
Is it kale?
No. Does start with a K.
Oh, kombucha.
Yes. Can you guess which one?
There's more than one.
Yeah, it's the Gingerade one.
I don't know anything about it.
It's a ginger-flavored.
Ginger-flavored. I know ginger ale. Does it taste like ginger ale?
Only vaguely. More like a ginger beer or ginger tea or... It's not sweet.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
I like ginger ale.
Okay.
I don't know about other ginger things.
Well, I'm sorry. You gotta take a brave, new, bold step into the world to try a Moscow Mule sometime.
Do you eat the ginger that comes with sushi?
I generally don't. I don't enjoy pickled ginger very much.
No, I don't either.
That was great.
Yeah, see, we're on the same page for at least for a portion of our ginger-related topics.
I'm glad we shared that with the world. but another thing that has come up today, aside from the happy, go fun, lucky stuff, I was kind of full of righteous, furious rage with Variety over their sort of doomsaying about originality and Hollywood being dead because Tomorrowland didn't do well at the box office last weekend. It only made $41 million. And then the same guy went on to write a piece about how San Andreas is going to do super well with a target of $40 million for this weekend, and how it's all about proving that originality can still work. And it has an illustration of Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson falling, jumping out of a helicopter with tickets that he's using as a rope. It's a very peculiar illustration they financed, but the illustration's not my problem. It's just irritating writing, and the same old lazy stuff of CGI razzle dazzle, which is actually words he put together, and made me want to flip a table.
Yeah, I saw the title and I couldn't bring myself to read the article.
Well, that's for the best, because you could guess what the article was. Like, it's just running through sort of a parody of those sorts of articles, where it's just like, the disaster movie franchise isn't really taking off unless you're Roland Emmerich, and it's just like...
That worked out super well for him.
Yeah, it was just like, what? Like, what is the point of that observation exactly? I don't know. It's just like, Poseidon didn't do well, and it's like, well... Really? Okay. I'm really just shocked. But again, he draws the observation that it's because originality can't exist, and you can't really build a franchise off of a disaster movie, because once the disaster's over, then you can't have like three movies about your disaster.
Well, you could do like Oblivion. That was post-disaster. Wait, did you see Oblivion?
I didn't see Oblivion because it had Tom Cruise in it.
You're going to have to get over your Tom Cruise thing. He makes some good movies.
Okay. Well, you were right about Edge of Tomorrow. I did enjoy it. But yes, I should see Oblivion. I kind of wanted to see it. It's just, I have to get over him being in it. But it's just a thing. Just a phobia. Well, my Cruise
Edge of Tomorrow was your Cruise phobia. Mm-hmm. Edge of Tomorrow was better if you were going to pick one or the other. So that's fine.
Mm-hmm. I guess that leaves us where we are at with the things.
Hmm. Well, before we move on, should we circle back to your endeavor with Marco? Are you going to continue that? We didn't really finish that conversation.
Oh yeah. Well, that's why I said he's getting a microphone and that we're going to try to continue that.
Any plans?
Yeah. Well, it's probably going to be like a bi-weekly thing, like not. And I don't think we're going to be talking about the same stuff we talk about on our show together, of which you and I generally agree about technology, except for your stupid watch.
My watch is not stupid.
Okay, well, he has a watch too, so you two can be pen pals and tell each other how great watches are and send each other doodles.
You know, the thing is about that, I filled up my little friend circle with all the people that I know who have watches, and none of them are people that I would even remotely feel comfortable sending doodles or heartbeats to.
Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So does that actually make you sad when you look at that circle, and sometimes you're just like, oh, I could send a doodle right now, and then you're just like, no, I'm
yeah,
not
it totally
gonna.
Does. It totally does. I look at some of these people, and I'm like, I know this person through like in like a professional manner or through the internet or something, and it would be so inappropriate for like a little ding on their wrist to go off and them to see my face. They would just be like, what in the hell is happening right now?
See, wait. Do you have Adam Lissagor's Mr. Sandwich?
I do. He actually doodled me back. He was the first person I doodled because he was the first person I knew who had a watch.
See, you have somebody that doodles with you. You have
a doodler. One time, but like I did it one time and I felt kind of bad about it because he's a busy guy and I didn't want to interrupt him. But mm-hmm. like I don't doodle people on a regular basis, and I don't think I've doodled anyone since the first time that I doodled him.
Well, you always remember your first time you doodled somebody.
Actually, no, that's not true. I sent an anonymous doodle to a goofy kid who used to live in Phoenix and now lives in Utah.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah, that one.
Kyle.
Yeah. I guess I'm officially saying, yes, Kyle, that was me who did that. Somebody. It wasn't somebody else from a phone number you don't know in Phoenix.
Yeah. Sorry, listener, Kyle. Oh, he also threatened and then came to L.A., but I was going to San Luis Obispo, so I don't know why he decided he would come to L.A. that weekend. That was weird.
You want to tell him that it was or was not on purpose? You didn't escape specifically because he was there?
Oh, no, it wasn't specifically because he was there. I mean, I probably would have avoided him, because it's just not in my nature to be around other humans.
We're going to have to work on your brand engagement.
We have to, I need to be socially adjusted to work with other people. Perhaps I should take baby steps to the elevator, baby steps to the lobby.
I was going to say that, but I was uncertain. I haven't seen that movie in probably 15 years.
It's a good movie. I like that movie. Mm. Did you know Richard Dreyfuss is suing, I can't remember who has the rights. It's either Warner Brothers or Sony or Paramount. I can't remember which one. He's suing them because he hasn't been getting the residuals he should be from the film because they've structured the payments in a certain way. It's just sort of amused me when I read that. It's just like, you go, Richard. You stick it to him.
Yeah, I think I saw that go by in the news feed a week or two ago or whenever that happened.
Yep.
He hasn't been around much lately.
No. Certainly hasn't had any new opuses lately.
I always liked the Star Wars audition parodies on SNL where, who was it, Daryl Hammond played Richard Dreyfuss, who was trying out to be C-3PO?
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, it was good.
Wait, who was the one that was playing Kevin Spacey?
No, Kevin Spacey was pretending to be other people.
Oh.
He was, Walter Matthau, and he was... Who else was he? It was somebody else trying out to be Han Solo.
Was he Christopher Walken?
I'm captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed, if it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon.
He was Christopher Walken, yes.
Well, yeah. Those are the days,
Comedy sketches are really funny when you reference and or vaguely describe them on podcasts.
Especially when you have them completely wrong.
Sure. I'll cut in some of the audio here. That'll make people laugh. That'll make them forget how dumb we are.
Okay, C-3PO. I'm sorry, who's in there?
It's Richard Dreyfuss. Damn you! I told you I didn't want to wear the damn mask!
Okay, just do the scene, Richard. What I really need is a droid that understands the binary languages of moisture evaporators.
Evaporators? Sir, my first job was programming binary load lifters. Very similar to your evaporators in most respects.
Thank you very much.
Now listen, I can do that better, okay?
Thanks, but we've got all we need.
Look, I don't need this! I was in Jaws, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I listened to Casey Liss on two separate podcast recordings this week demonstrate a mug that doesn't fall over by putting the microphone up to it. so you know, you can't really go wrong with recording things on podcasts is what I found.
You want to discuss beverage and laptop workflows while recording podcasts?
No, but I did put both of the pint glasses down, one with my naturally alkaline spring water and the other with my kombucha in next to the laptop. And then I was like, you know, I don't think I'm going to spill, but nobody thinks they're going to spill. And then I moved over a little table and I put it on it next to it. So I'm hoping that I won't suffer a similar fate and then need to demonstrate a mug that doesn't tip over.
Yeah. He's recorded more episodes of shows than we have, but I haven't spilled anything either. But then again, my laptop is always elevated. What is this? Like 8 inches off the table with, surprisingly the cheapest laptop elevation system is, a 750 sheets ream of paper from Target. I have two of them holding up my laptop and I have two of them holding up each of my, monitors. So really the only thing I would ruin if I spilled this bottle of water is my, Wacom tablet and my, DOS keyboard probably.
Okay. I have my laptop sitting on top of my table with a, you know, the 1990s CD case book things that you'd zip up all the way around? The single ones?
A CD wallet?
Yeah, CD wallet, but this one stores like, you know, 20 to 25. Not one of the big ones. And so there's like 20 to 25 CDs inside of this case, and it's zipped up, and it is underneath my laptop, supporting it. And then there's a tripod for my microphone, and it has a hand towel folded underneath it, so that you don't hear the table vibrate.
That's a productivity hack right there, is what that is.
Yeah, it's a life hack.
Oh yeah, that is you. You just posted a picture on Twitter. I saw it. Oh, look at that. You got a. That is a disgusting looking beverage in that glass.
I'm gonna let you guess that which one's the water and which one's the kombucha.
Well, the see through one is probably water, and the one that looks like microwaved hot chocolate is probably the kombucha.
Yeah, well, in person it looks more like, I don't know, a Hefeweizen or something.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of wheat beers.
Ah, I like wheat beers. I don't like Saisons, the Belgian farm ales. I find them too farmy for my taste.
Grass-fed beer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. They have a certain herbaceous muskiness to them that I don't enjoy. but I also don't like sour, bitter things, even though, you know, the kombucha is like basically on the threshold for me. If it was more sour, I'd probably be like one of those saisons.
I don't know what any of that means, but I have noticed you have something sort of like our show art as your background on your laptop.
I do, but it doesn't have the color test pattern. It's just the one without that I sent you.
My phone is apparently not on. U2 is ruining our podcast right now. They're meerkatting, and I just got a notification. U2 is the worst band ever, specifically because of that.
I'm surprised you still have Meerkat installed.
I am too. I haven't opened that, and frankly, I haven't really opened Periscope in a while either. But yeah, Meerkat. Haven't used that since Periscope came out.
Can we talk about what complete failures those two things are before we talk about our movie today?
I don't think they're failures, but we can talk about it.
Okay. I think that they work well if you are someone who is broadcasting to an audience where you have like hundreds of people that you don't need to like talk to or want to talk to, where you're going to max out on the chat threshold and then you won't have to worry about dealing with any people that actually say anything. I think it works great for those sorts of audiences, but if it's like someone around your level or my level where you fire it up and then you get like a couple people sending you messages and stuff, then it's just like, well, this isn't that entertaining for me, and you can't really like go on whenever your friend just happens to be periscoping something or whatever, and it doesn't even cache these things for longer than 24 hours, so it's just not it doesn't have a lot of longevity to it either. It's a very weird thing. And so, like, I notice people that have large followings using Periscope or Meerkat, and almost exclusively Periscope now. But I don't see any of the normaler people doing it that used to be doing it right when the service came out.
Yeah, the broadcasts have certainly dropped off quite a lot, at least with the people I follow since it came out, which is understandable, I guess. There's some novelty that wears off, and I think people are still trying to figure out how to use it. But I think it's got a ton of potential. I mean, yes, they do last for 24 hours, and I have watched a few replays when I miss things because I'm not as hot to open something up as soon as I see a notification. When it was brand new, I would just fire up every Periscope stream that I would see come through on my little notification because I was intrigued by the whole idea. But in the same way that all of the various social networks provide you with a different in route to learn about people on the internet and to sort of make internet friends, I think the live video interaction is, you know, it's one step closer to making friends with people that you can't or won't ever meet. It's, you know, we talk to people on Twitter who we haven't met or won't meet, and there's so much more that can be accomplished when you're actually directly communicating with people, like when you meet someone in person. It dramatically enhances the relationship that you have with them going forward, because you have so much more interaction in a short period of time when you're actually talking with somebody. And I think Periscope isn't quite the same as meeting someone in person in terms of how much you can get to know a person, but there's a lot you can do. You can get a look into somebody's life. You can see what they're like moving around in their own little environment. And I think that's an interesting way to create a connection between different people on the internet. So I like it.
Okay. Well, when was the last time you used it to send anything out to the world?
The last time I personally broadcast something?
Yes.
You want an exact date? It was like two and a half, 3 weeks ago.
Okay, so that's a long time. Compare that to the last time you used Twitter.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so it's interesting to broadcast if you're an interesting person who does interesting things. It's fun to watch for pretty much those same reasons. But since I don't leave my house all that often, it's not terribly appealing for me to be the broadcaster, but the viewer in this instance. So the last time I broadcast something, it was just, you know, when I was doing that video shoot. And next time I do something interesting, maybe I will fire up another broadcast, but my life is mundane.
All right. And when was the last time you watched something on there?
Like 2-3 days ago.
Okay. Would you say you watched something about 2-3 days apart every now and then?
There was a very large gap in between there because I was very busy. But, okay.
So it's not a good service if you want to like be a completionist or keep on top of things. It's not a good service if you want to actually have a personal interaction with anyone. Because even if somebody has like 100,000 followers, you can still send them a tweet and maybe they'll see it and maybe they'll reply. Not so with Periscope. And if you are on a level where you want to have a really personal, intimate, heavy air quotes, conversation with somebody, then FaceTime or Skype or Google Hangouts or whatever is going to serve your needs better than Periscope, because it's only going to let one person write stuff to you and send you hearts.
Right. It's a half step towards having a FaceTime conversation with somebody, because it's sort of a one-way FaceTime thing. But I find value in it in the same way that I find value in Vine, in that it is a quick and easy and accessible way to broadcast a portion of your life to the world that you want to see or that you want people to know about. And it stays up for 24 hours so people can go watch that in the same way they could watch like a Vine or Instagram. Because, I mean, let's face it, basically posting something like a video on Vine or Instagram is essentially gone in 24 hours anyway, just based on the volume of things. So I don't know. I think it's interesting to have this immediate accessible video broadcast where you can actually, I mean, you can see the replay of people asking questions too. So it's kind of a live event, and I don't know, it brings people in and allows them to feel comfortable broadcasting in a way that they might not feel comfortable if you were to tweet at somebody and go like, hey man, want to have a FaceTime call? They'd be like, what is the matter with you? Like, it lets them decide whether or not they want to put themselves out there, and they can ignore the comments altogether and just make a little performance, which some people do, or they can try and interact with the audience. And I don't know. I think it's an interesting way to further build relationships on the internet, which is a thing that I enjoy, because I don't really build a lot of relationships with people in person because I work and live in my house and I'm surrounded by old people and I don't really go a lot of places. So, for me, I enjoy it.
Okay.
I crave human interaction, Joe. I'll take it any way I can get it.
It's the drips and drabs, from YouTube.
YouTube, not so much, but sure.
Sorry, I meant to say YouTube. I don't know why I said YouTube.
Oh, no. I don't want to. I don't know why I'm following YouTube on Meerkat. I should go and follow them right now.
Do you want me to give you a little hint? Because you're not following them. Meerkat decided that you would be interested, and they worked out some sort of a business deal. And so that's why you got that notification.
No, I think when Meerkat was brand new, I followed a ton of people. I may actually be following you too, which would be a
on
terrible
purpose?
Thing for me to do. Not on purpose, but like they were the only ones that were there when it was brand new. There weren't a lot of people.
Wait, whoa, hold the phone, Dan. Did you keep your free U2 album that Tim Cook gave you?
I may have, but
oh my god,
I think I didn't want to go through the rigmarole of trying to delete it through iTunes Match, so I just unchecked all the boxes, so it will never play on my laptop.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't use iTunes Match, and it's there's an online web tool, which is one button, and I pushed it, and it's gone. Yay!
Did Apple provide a web tool for removing the U2 album?
Yes, because so many people complained.
I thought there was like an instruction list of what you got to do to get rid of it. So I was just like, nah, whatever. I'll leave it. Don't care.
Well, no, that's what it was originally. It was like all kinds of like hacky stuff you could do to get rid of it. But if you had like iTunes Match or some other cloud syncing component, because I think it shows up in your purchases still, even though you didn't buy it. And then it would potentially download if you were like restoring your phone or something like that. So to get rid of it forever, you have to do all kinds of like convoluted stuff. But the web tool would get rid of it forever for you. And so then you didn't have to do the convoluted stuff. That came later though. I think the point is, a lot of people have strong feelings about you two.
Well, yes, I can confirm that the album is in fact on my phone in iTunes Match. So I didn't delete it.
Because it's your jam.
I don't think I've ever listened to it, but I didn't delete it.
When you go on Mike Hurley's Inquisitive behind the album thing, and you're discussing your favorite music album ever, it's going to be that YouTube album.
No, it's definitely not.
That would be kind of funny though if someone did pick that on that show, on that podcast show. Could you imagine just like someone defending the indefensible by going up there and saying that's the best album that they love so much? Man, that would make for good podcasting.
Yeah, there would certainly be much to talk about. It wouldn't be a dull conversation, that's for sure.
Speaking of dull conversations, we should talk about our movie now.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
We'll cut out the preceding 26 minutes and make it nice and condensed.
Okay, sure. Hello, listeners, for the first time.
Probably this is a movie we've been talking about since episode one of this show, if you can believe it.
Yes, S1E1, as they say.
Because we're going to have multiple seasons. But I had asked you if you'd seen it, and you said no, and it took you apparently about a year to get around to it, because it's finally available on the Netflix.
Actually, I think it was available on Netflix since last October.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, and I think you had even suggested it back then. It was like, you know, I'm not super feeling it, and so I didn't watch it. I've had other opportunities. I think I was on a plane once, and it was one of the movies you could watch. Now, having watched it, I don't know why that was available to watch on a plane.
Well, that'd be a terrible idea.
Yeah. But yeah, so I've seen it now. And I probably should have re-listened to our first episode. So listeners, if you actually did that research and it sounds like we're repeating ourselves, or that I'm saying something that I didn't say before, or Dan's saying something that you didn't say before, it's probably because we didn't care enough to actually check. So we're sorry.
Something, something, Tarantino indulgence, something, something, 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Yes. And it is, wow. It is a thing. We're not going to go beat by beat through this because I don't have that kind of stamina, and I don't I didn't prepare for that. I don't have trail mix or anything. But the
and to be clear, I like this movie, but the prospect of rewatching the entire thing just for this show was borderline exhausting until I hit play, and it's like, okay, I forgot. I enjoy watching this movie, so it's not that big a deal. But the idea of sitting down with the intent where you have to watch this entire thing, that was almost exhausting for me, and I like this movie. But do you like the movie? Did you enjoy yourself?
I like the movie, but I have problems with the movie. I don't think it is his best film, and I don't think it is his worst film. I think it is definitely a Tarantino film. it is unquestionably a Tarantino film, but it is actually kind of fascinating in terms of its the things it does right and the things it does, I think, in my opinion, wrong. Chiefly among those, as you pointed out, is the length of the picture, which is absurd. It's banana pants. I don't understand it, because how did you write this thing and then say, yes, I'm going to film this and it will be one film and I will make people sit through it? And then as you've pointed out before, there was an extra, what, half an hour, 45 minutes worth of material that was cut from this movie?
Supposedly.
Yes. That he would like to restore. So,
or at least find a way to show people.
Yes. Well, that would... I don't think he's just going to show like random clips. Like, deleted scenes start. But he has all this extra material that's not in the movie, which was supposed to originally be there. And I wonder if maybe something went awry in the planning stages when you were trying to figure out how long your movie was going to be. Because it's just not a good goal, in my opinion. I know that there are other long movies that we've also talked about before. The Avengers 2 is a very long movie. Interstellar is a long movie. All kinds of things are long movies. They exist. But this movie did not really need to be this long, and it feels that way when you watch it. And it even has a certain structure to it where it's in three parts, and it's sort of like the first part feels like it's way too long, like almost like it goes on for a really, really long time. It's interesting, but it ultimately has very little to do with any of the subsequent parts. So it's almost like it's its own episode. And I think you had mentioned to me offline that he was considering at some point doing a release of this as a miniseries or something. Or he was going to
four parts or something. Yeah.
Well, I don't know where he was going to divide it into four, but I would divide it into three. Like he's got the beginning of the thing where we are set up with Django and Schultz and Fritz the horse, who I love. I love Fritz the horse. And
you love Fritz the horse, who has precisely two scenes where he just nods.
Yes, well, that's the best part.
he's
a trained horse. So Fritz the horse is great. Everybody else is pretty good, too. Christoph Waltz is, I think, one of the things that really sells the movie. Jamie Foxx offers a great performance. I think all of the performances in general are very good. I think Jonah Hill is not. I think that is frankly a bad performance.
I thought he was pretty good. He was actually supposed to be in this more.
I found his cameo distracting. I found his bad fake old-timey Southern accent to be deplorable. I did not care for him. You could have cast all kinds of other better people, all kinds of other better people in that role, and they didn't. So he's there in his cameo role. Speaking of bad accents and cameos,
we all think Jonah's cameo was a nice idea, but next time we'll do it right.
I'm gonna let you edit that out.
Why would I do that?
I don't know. I don't know why you said it. But speaking
it was
of bad
the guy
accents,
with the baghead.
Yes, well, the sack, technically. But the end of the film, there's also Tarantino's appearance with his questionable cameo and bad accent.
Dreadful.
And it is just, it didn't need it, but that whole thing didn't really need to be there, but we'll get to that later.
You want to talk about someone from The Rocketeer, act like you're not acting. Good Lord, Tarantino.
Oh, it's so bad. So bad. Any Tarantino performance that has ever existed where you thought that he was bad, this is worse than that. This
makes his Pulp Fiction performance look so much better.
Yes, that was nuanced compared to what's offered up here. it is just ridiculously bad. It is definitely a situation where, again, he probably could have walked up to somebody at a 7-Eleven. Grabbed them, brought them to the shoot, and they would have done a better job than him. Anyway, I got sidetracked. The beginning of the movie, it takes forever, and we basically just have the scene of him being freed, and then they develop an alliance to go after these three very abusive people that worked for his former master. Go in, take care of him on Big Daddy's plantation, played by Don Johnson, in a very ridiculous but effective performance. They kill those guys, and then they evade Big Daddy. They have their funny little put a lantern on it scene where they are joking around about how they can't see anything. and having masks and stuff. And while there are things that should be cut for time, I feel like there's enough flavor provided by that scene that I would be sad to see it go, even though it does have Jonah Hill in it and he's doing a terrible job. But then...
I like Jonah.
Okay. And then there's also like a weird edit in that part too that threw me off, where they have them like running up to the thing and then they cut back to them planning. It was like...
There's a lot of sort of... out of sync edits in this that some work and some don't so much, but I thought it was at least interesting. And I'm curious how much of that was because the traditional, more straightforward method of telling a story like this might just be kind of blah, and Tarantino's really trying to put his stamp on the Western genre that he really tried to mix it up a little bit. And I thought a lot of the back and forth here and there worked. Some of the things that I thought were nuts were like the one shot cutaways, like the first time, Django is describing the fact that he's married, and there's that one shot cutaway to Kerry Washington sitting on the swing, and she goes, "They call me Hildy," and she nods, and they cut away, and like that's it for like the rest of the until like we see her at the end of the movie. It's those sorts of things are baffling to me, but the somewhat out of sequence editing I thought was relatively effective.
No, there are like a few figments of his imagination of her like hanging out around as we progress through the film.
Right.
But the but they defeat Big Daddy, well, kill him really, and that sets up reinforces the existing alliance they had, and Schultz says, "Okay, well, come with me. We'll work the winter, and you'll be a free man, and we'll go after your wife." And, you know, we have that scene where he kills the sheriff in that town, and then go get the marshal now. You know, don't get him first, get him now. And they do that thing, and then they make their way off to snow and stuff. And they have their conversations about Hildy, about Broomhilda, and then, of course, hanging another lantern on it. Oh, of course she speaks German, and blah, 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 the whole explanation. This part of the movie kind of drags through here, because then they're killing that one guy who has the farm. Now, it does set up some important parts for them. So, it's like one of those things where it's like, you can't really cut it, but, like, this is... ultimately one of the very few threads that might carry through to the end, you know, where we're describing the morality of what they're doing, where they're a bounty hunter and they're gonna kill this guy because he's a bad person, and just because he's decided to be a good person now doesn't mean that he wasn't a bad person before and he doesn't deserve to die. Now, one might argue that he could be theoretically brought to justice or something, but yeah, sure.
You know, it's 1858. They're not really looking for those sort of subtleties. And I should point out that this particular scene does in fact come back to be literally the end of the movie. But you know, there is a lot of Tarantino flavor sprinkled all over this thing, probably to the point where it kind of overpowers a bit. But I generally, maybe it's because I'm familiar with the story a little bit, that I'm okay with the pacing of this. Like, there are a lot of moments that are indulgent, and that's kind of what you sign up for when you go see a Tarantino movie. But I feel like the pacing and the at least the rate with which Schultz and Django sort of get to know each other and their relationship evolves for the first third of the movie, because it is basically about a third of the way through the movie till we have that giant title graphic that says, "And so they had a very fruitful winter and blah blah blah, here we go to Mississippi." That first third of the movie I think actually serves the characters really well, and sure, it probably could have been shorter, but I kind of like the way it worked just as is.
But you see what I'm saying about where it feels like it's an episode, like it sort of like sets up, but in like a sort of almost completely self-contained way.
Yes. If this was a play, there would be an intermission at that graphic.
Yes. There could have been, but the,
that's where the second VHS would be required to be put in if this was on VHS.
Or they could just do it Monty Python and the Holy Grail style. But
part one, and then just you could just do Monty Python, just do part one, and then never do the rest of the parts.
Oh, but they had the intermission, remember, in the Holy Grail and the music.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, never mind. But one of the interesting parts of this first, I guess, this first act or whatever you want to describe it as, is we get a lot of the sense of the stuff that Django has to deal with in his life, and the prevailing attitudes of the people around him, which are not great. This is bad. So it can be very uncomfortable to sit through some of the disgusting, horrible, small-minded idiocy that's in here. But
there are a couple of scenes in this movie that I just write in all caps in my notes, just brutal. Like, so some of them are not even things that I really care to look directly at anymore. I kind of look at them out of the side of my eye, and it's one of those things where whether it's indulgent on Tarantino's part or a reflection of reality, like, you know, things like this very well may have occurred in real life, and it's just horrifying that this is a thing that we are looking at, and that's certainly the point, especially when we get to Calvin Candy, that he's well and thoroughly vilified in the first moments that we meet him.
Yeah. Well, now here comes a thing, though, where while I think that the blood splatter that's in this movie is completely gratuitous, I don't think that the sort of behavioral treatment of things is gratuitous. I think that somehow, even though, you know, it is often played broadly, is important for grounding this film. As reprehensible and difficult as it is to sit through, it needs to be there. The second act of this, like you're saying, starts basically with that title card, and we get the Greenville slowly trucking off the screen. And then the horrible markets there. And we have the conversation where Django decides that, you know, he's going to have to... Christoph explains the using this metaphor of, like, you know, if you try to buy a horse from a farmer, you know, the farmer's not going to sell you the horse, but if you try to buy the farm for a ridiculous amount of money and then try to buy the horse, then everything works out okay. So they set up their plan, and then, you know, Django's very uncomfortable with having to be a black slaver, and says there's nothing lower than that, but he forces himself to inhabit that role for the rest of the film. And he becomes increasingly more determined as the movie progresses from this point, and Schultz becomes increasingly less sure of himself and what he's doing, and falters, particularly at the end. And we sort of see the two split in a way, where Django has the determination and the perseverance and the will to see something through to the very end and not break character, where Schultz just can't manage it and breaks by the end.
Throughout the entire getting to know him, we sort of get the feeling that he is not a fan of, whether it's because he is German or not, he is turned off by the pervasive attitudes of the American slave trade and the people who make this their business, particularly Calvin Candy once he meets him. But he's trying to keep up his charade, and he does what he can to sort of enforce his version of humanity, especially in that opening scene where, you know, he lets them go and gives them the two options. He said, well, you can help this guy out if you want, or you can kill him and go about your own business, whatever you want to do. But once he's so deep into his plan, and you could discuss the merits of his plan, because many people have, once he's in it, he becomes overwhelmed by the fact that he has lost control, and he is trying to impose, at least on his own life, his idea of the way things should be and the way you should treat other people. But as Calvin Candy gets the better of him, he's kind of smacked down and told that, no, this is the way we do things around here. And he can't have any of that, even to the point of his own death, which is, you know, inevitably what happens, but he lives according to his own beliefs, and is, he pays for it, but, he's definitely a man in his own, on this one. And, you know, he does what he can to help people out. But yeah, that is ultimately his undoing, the fact that he can't justify what the rest of the world is around him.
Yeah. And well, the rest of this part of the film, this sort of like second middle part, is building up to that. The whole thing of ingratiating themselves to Candy, and going up to his apartment there, and seeing the brutal fight to the death take place, and then conning their way into appearing at Candy's ranch, Candyland, which is disturbing on a whole bunch of levels. They go and they are on their trip there. They run across D'Artagnan, who had escaped, and they watch him be ripped apart by these dogs. And it is disturbing, again, but also because Christoph Waltz almost... This is that first step of him losing sight of the plan overall and wanting to help this man out, and Django sticking to the plan wholeheartedly, firmly, and letting this man basically die in order to get what he wants at the end of the film. It is uncomfortable to go through that process and that struggle. Then we go to the ranch. We have the convoluted thing of trying to meet with Broomhilda, but she was in the hot box. And this is where we're also introduced to Samuel L. Jackson, who, you know, at like whatever this is, 2 hours and 30 minutes into the film, I'm just like, an hour and 30 minutes into the film, I was like, where was he hiding? So he finally makes his appearance. He plays, I think, a very different character than what I maybe had envisioned in my mind. A very despicable person, who feels, of course, threatened by Django and wants to undermine and destroy his plans and him. And he succeeds in many ways in this. So they do their whole thing. They have dinner. She's aware that Django's there. They're doing the dinner service. Steven figures this all out, tells Calvin, who up until this point was totally unaware of what was going on. And now Calvin's in on it. And this is where everything takes a really uncomfortable turn, for the viewer and for the characters, because they do the whole phrenology scene, which is weird.
Well, I think this is an important part of this movie and what separates this from what this movie could have been. So Samuel Jackson's character is absolutely despicable. But in that scene where he sort of pulls Calvin Candy into the study there and they talk about, you know, what's actually happening, you see that there's a very different relationship between the two of them than the one they present to other people, which is fascinating on a number of levels. They don't really explore it all that much, but Stephen isn't just there to be Calvin Candy's sort of just like head of the house. Like he is a trusted member of this sort of inner circle that he has, and the two are sort of working together, and it could almost, you know, be questioned who is actually in charge of what. But the phrenology thing, it comes up twice when we first see them having dinner around that table. I think that's back when they first meet him after the fight, and then when he does the cutting open of the skull. The thing about this is Calvin Candy doesn't view himself as a bad guy. He views himself as completely justified in all of his actions, whether that's because of just the way he was brought up or the environment of the 1858 that this movie is getting us to believe in. The reason he is a compelling character and not just a cartoon bad guy is because he firmly believes in these things he's saying. He firmly believes, as ridiculous as it is, that, you know, there is a separation between the species. Some are physically different and inferior to others, and he's trying to justify and prove this to everyone, even though he is clearly bat poop crazy. But the fact that he doesn't vilify himself, or he doesn't look at himself as like the big bad guy have to screw everyone, that's what makes him an even match against Christoph, and you know, different ideology in the way they come at the world, and clearly they clash, but that's what makes this such a tense and interesting scene, at least in my eyes.
Yeah, but I would argue that he knows what he's doing is wrong, because he sends his sister away before he does this. So he has some capacity to understand what would be appropriate in certain contexts, and so it's weird. I don't completely agree that he's not a cartoon. There is some, like, if he had a mustache, he would have twirled it. There's some stuff in here where he's chewing scenery, especially with this scene. Now it can be argued, of course, that he's doing this as a distraction so that nobody is paying attention to the fact that what's his face is coming up behind them with the shotgun in the hallway, and then he busts in, robs them of their guns, and then you realize there's still an hour left of the film.
Well, I think a lot of his showmanship comes from sort of an inferiority complex where he feels like he should be the most important person in the room, and when people are attempting to get the better of him, he is going to make sure he smacks them down in his own way. And I kind of viewed him sending his sister away as a he knows things are going to get serious with the guns shortly, and he wants to keep that away from the ladies because, you know, it's down to business now, and it's going to get a little graphic. But he snaps a little bit on his own when this sort of like faux charm that he has. And I love that he bills himself as a Francophile, but he doesn't speak French. So it'll make him feel inferior. Don't speak French to him because it'll insult him. Like he pretends to be this sort of gentleman, but when it's revealed that he really is just sort of this trashy, terrible human being that he can't help but just sort of get ruffled and want to kill everyone in the room.
Yeah. Well, It's obvious from when we first meet him, like you're saying, even in that introduction before we see him, that he is not as sophisticated and worldly and educated, and he doesn't have what he wants to project that he has. And that in many ways, like you're saying, it is inferiority that drives a lot of this. And it is very, weird. But the, after this scene where they have this confrontation, they take the $12,000 that he was carrying in his wallet, and they go to sign the papers. There is now a lady playing a harp because... And
it was the style of the time.
Yeah, and so the Beethoven she's playing on the harp drives Christoph to remember the death of D'Artagnan, and he kind of loses it a little bit and slips a little further from having control over the situation, and Calvin goes to talk to him about it. We again see that Calvin doesn't actually understand anything about the Three Musketeers and D'Artagnan and the author of the Three Musketeers, and so it shows sort of the inferiority where he wants to appear. He puts on all this bluster, but the other thing in the scene, of course, is the handshake. Where they could get out scot-free, maybe, I don't know, who knows, if he would have just shot him when they walked out of the door. But here it does seem that it was at least a potential to get out scot-free. And there is the awkward refusal to shake his hand. And at first it's like, well, just shake his hand, dude. Just get out of there. Just go run. But, you know, on the other hand, it's like, well... this is a disgusting human being, and if you shake his hand now, then aren't you going to remember that you couldn't stand for anything at this point in your life? And so Christoph shoots Calvin right in the carnation, and it is also Christoph's undoing when he does this, and so we get Calvin and Christoph dead, and it's sort of a mirror, the two of them, one the actual educated person that goes around killing people for justice reasons in dentistry, and then the other person who is a horrible human being. They're taken out of the picture, and at first I was like, that's kind of depressing, because you would kind of want, I guess, in a traditional Hollywood structure, for him to carry along to the end and not be like Ben Kenobi'd here, but he's taken out, and I think it's actually more powerful that way, because Django now has to be the sole hero driving the rest of the action forwards for the next 45 minutes.
I suppose it could be argued that Schultz actually standing up for what he believes in rather than sort of kowtowing to Candy just to get out of the room is kind of one of the things that Django takes forward, because, you know, the characteristics of Schultz, where he was, you know, kind, and even though he may have been deceptive, to the people around him, he was doing things for, to be a good human being to other people. Django sort of carries that forward, especially once, you know, we get to Tarantino's, ridiculous cameo and killing of those terrible folks and sort of freeing of the other slaves that were in the cage there with him. But, this whole scene, I think between all of the characters is fascinating on a number of levels, because, you know, Schultz is very clearly breaking because he's sort of having that flashback to the fact that he's getting Candy's getting the better of him. And this is the kind of guy who did this horrible thing with the dogs killing D'Artagnan, which is where he's having the flashback. And he just can't bear to be beat by this guy. And neither of them are really backing down. There's so much passive aggressive, back and forth in this, you know, when he brings him the cake, trying to, you know, gloat, and he says, I don't go for sweets or whatever. But, you know, the very first thing he does when, Calvin gives him those papers is he immediately signs Brumhilda's freedom and has Calvin sort of sign his name as well, just to make the document certified. So just flaunting it right in front of his face that this woman is now free, just because screw you, man. That's what I'm going to do here. And, you know, the whole, normally I would say Auf Wiedersehen, but that means until I see you and I never want to see you again, so I say goodbye. Like, all of that back and forth is just tension on so many different levels, and neither of the men will back down because they believe they're right. And in Schultz's case, he is actually right, and Candy is just a terrible human being. And I think I may have made this up, but I think I saw an interview with Tarantino where he was talking about just how this tension just it did get to Schultz so much that right down to the moment where he wasn't even sure what he was going to do, right up until the moment where he was walking up to Calvin Candy, he was going to shake his hand, but he could not bear it. And in that very moment, right before he shot him, that's when he decided to kill him. There was no plan, just up until that moment where they were having their back and forth. Like, that's just what sent him over the edge. And he's like, you know what? Couldn't help myself, which is what he actually says. And then we get that insane, slow motion shot where he's blasted back against the wall. But I think there's a ton of subtle back and forth in just the actions and the dialogue between Christoph Waltz and Leonardo DiCaprio in that scene that is expertly done, and of course does transition us into the third act. And I think a lot of that does set up the attitude that Django takes forward, and some of the trickery, of course, is stuff that he learns from Schultz. But that is part three of the film, that you can see why it's built on part two. But here we go into the next stage, where our before main character is now deceased.
Yeah, and this is also in a way a mirror of the first act of the film. First we have the big shootout that goes on for forever, and he kills a lot of people, and there's blood everywhere. This I feel is gratuitous, because it doesn't really build to anything. We already know that Django is willing to kill if he's threatened or for justice, and so this doesn't serve any real purpose. the killing in this part. I'm speaking narratively, of course.
Like, sure. Other than like the righteous vengeance, like when he kills the Brittle brothers and we see the little bit of their past and to what they did, like it kind of feels good to watch Django kill them or beat him in slow motion with that whip and then shoot him. Like that's sort of the righteous vindication. But at this point, it's borderline gratuitous, especially for the narrative.
Well, especially since this shootout here is mostly killing off people that we don't know.
Oh, yes, there's that.
So it doesn't there's no vindication or vengeance or vendetta or anything here. There's a whole,
except
like,
the lawyer guy. We get the lawyer guy first.
Yeah, well, he was a jerk. Then also the mustache guy, the tall mustache guy with the bowler hat. But you know, everybody else we don't know. Like, there's like what, 5, 6, 7 guys that are all killed here. There's blood all over this foyer. So that's done. And he, of course, Steven, realizes what to do and has the guy threaten to kill Broomhilda with a gun to her head unless he backs down. And so he backs down, naturally, because it would be a shame if that actually were to come to pass at this point in the film. We transition to one of the disgusting, horrible people that worked for Calvin going to torture Django when he's hanging upside down and mostly naked. And part of that is going to be this big castration scene. And then Steven comes in and says, no, you're not doing that anymore. We're not going to go through with that. And then he leaves, and Steven explains in this long speech about how Miss Laura has this perfect plan and how they're going to send him to this mine, and he's just going to have a number, and he's just going to have to pound away on rocks the rest of his life, and that it's just going to be the worst thing in the whole wide world, and it's way better than just killing him right now, and it's way better than doing anything else, and way better than just bleeding him out and letting him die soon. So it just really sets up that Steven's thoroughly, through and through, not a good person. And it also
reinforces his sort of deeper relationship with Calvin Candy, that it was sort of like a family member that Django killed, and he's not just going to get away with that. He actually wants to torture him because, hey, when you've got the ability to torture people at hand, potentially you're going to use that, because that's not a horrible thing to do whenever you get the whim to do it.
Yeah, and so he gets clothes and gets sent off with one person from America and two people from Australia. One of those Australians more from Australia than the other one. Then they have a cut of Kerry Washington being thrown into a room with a quilt and then locked in sort of a standalone cabin thing. It's not clear to me narratively why that was important, other than he rescues her from that room later. Like, they never set up like that she was going to be punished or that she would be tortured or that anything bad would happen to her necessarily. Just that she got locked in that room, in that cabin. But I'm going to assume it wasn't going to be good. Anyway, terrible scene with Tarantino. Terrible, god-awful scene with Tarantino. He very creatively blows up, and he gets Django gets the other thing of dynamite, frees the other slaves who were going with him to the mine. He rides back to Candyland after having deceived these guys, and he's going to go get Broomhilda by force, which is awfully daring, but it works out well for him, because everyone is away at Calvin's funeral, and so he has plenty of time to run primer cord through the around the doorframe. It's very weird how he zigzagged that for, I don't know why.
Well, the first thing he does is he goes and busts in on the crew cabin where everyone is hanging out, painting birdhouses and taking baths in a bucket, and kills all of them in one quick go around, and then goes back and rigs up his debt cord.
Yeah, can we talk about that for a second? Because I was confused. There was one lady who was with them who was always wearing a bandana over her face.
Yeah, she got a couple close-up shots, too. Presumably, maybe she had some footage that was cut out. I don't know why.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't it feel like the kind of shots where it's like we're supposed to know something about her? She's supposed to do something important? Well, ultimately, nothing happens.
Yeah, did you happen to notice when he first frees Django in the beginning of the movie and they ride in to go shoot Sheriff Bill Sharp? When they're riding through and everyone is going, holy crap, look at that, it's Django on a horse. Did you happen to notice that Amber Tamblyn is one of the people standing looking out of a window?
No.
Amber Tamblyn, relatively well-known actress, is looking out a window at them as they ride by, and that is literally it. Like, every time I see that, I go, why is Amber Tamblyn standing in a window? Why is that not just an extra? And where did the rest of her footage go? What is happening right now?
Well, she's been in the... Did you watch the Amy Schumer show on Comedy Central?
I see parts here and there, but no, I don't really watch it regularly.
She was in that for some reason last night, so... I'll have to go back and look for Amber Tamblyn to evaluate her performance against that.
Her dad's in this too, I guess. I can't remember what part he plays, but he has a slightly bigger role. But every time I see somebody like a well-known actor who has like 3 seconds of screen time where they don't say anything or do anything, I go, well, that must have been something that got cut out there. And I think it's the same thing with this masked woman that we don't know anything about.
Yeah, or it could just be like, you know, people are like, yeah, sure, I'll be in your crazy movie, Quentin. That sounds like fun. Sure, I'll show up for a day. No big deal.
Well, that is kind of what happened with Jonah. I can't remember what other movie he was on, but he really wanted to be in the Tarantino movie, and Tarantino really wanted him, so he got like his day's worth of shooting in with the Baghead scene, his character being Baghead number two.
I can't say enough bad things about his performance. I'm not a Jonah Hill hater. I like him in the appropriate Jonah Hill context. This is not it. But the whole destruction of the mansion. He rescues Broomhilda. He goes inside the house, rigs it up. They all come back in from their funeral, mourning, obviously. He tells the two servants to go step away from Miss Laura, and then he shoots Miss Laura in what is the most physically impossible way possible. She flies backwards completely at there's no angle at which that makes sense from where he shot her at the top of the stairs.
It's on par with the blood and the Western amped up Tarantino style film that it's ridiculous, but it's the kind of thing that you want to see happen.
No, it isn't. It's sort of like there's two warring parts to this film. There's the serious, there's bad stuff happening part, and then there's like the wacky 1970s Western blaxploitation stuff that he throws in there, which he loves so much in everything that he does. But those two things are conflicting here, where it's like almost like True Grit, but then someone goes flying backwards.
Well, like, I mean, weird. The same thing with Schultz and the shotgun. Like, that wouldn't happen. And then, like, the bookcase just being torn to shreds by the shotgun pellets that go past him as he flies into the wall. I think that shot is phenomenal and incredibly cinematic, but it's completely ridiculous. I mean, to be perfectly honest, a human being getting shot with a bullet is incredibly anticlimactic. It does not look anything like anyone who has ever been shot in a movie.
You mean like five gallons of red corn syrup don't just explode from them?
No, people ostensibly are standing and then they fall over. That's really all that happens when a bullet hits a person. But this being a movie, you want more out of it, especially when they are terrible people that you want to see die.
Yes. And die they do. But he saves Steven for last. And Steven puts down his cane. And it is very clear that he never needed his cane. It is another character affectation that they throw in for Steven that I don't know why they did it. I mean, it sort of like builds in stuff that you can sort of expand on, like with his character history off screen or something. like,
yeah, in case you missed the subtlety where he was having a drink with Calvin Candy, this is really letting you in on the fact that, yes, Steven had a bigger role in this household than we're letting on, which I didn't need the cane thing, but maybe somebody did. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, he does it. And it is he has this very confrontational tone, not dissimilar to the scene between Calvin and Schultz, but in this case, there is no power imbalance, you know, in favor of the bad guys. This is the power imbalance in favor of the good guys, where Django is going to kill Steven, and he waits till Steven says his piece, says his whole thing, and then kneecaps him twice, and then sets the house on fire. Sets the primer cord on fire, and that explodes the house, and then giant explosion, and then they ride off. He puts his sunglasses on before it explodes.
Crooked, standing which always bothers me.
Yeah, well, these things are hard to put on. It's like wire. And then he gets on his horse with Broomhilda, and they go off to do whatever it is they're going to go do.
You can't forget the horse dance where he makes the horse step strut forward very slowly.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I hated that. I hated that so
much. It's one of my favorite silly little things. He makes the horsey dance.
I didn't care for it. I felt the tone was completely wrong for what was happening.
He's showboating for his lady because, you know, he's on top of the world. He just killed all the bad guys.
I love you so much. I just killed all of these people. And now I'm going to make my horse dance. it's a little off.
Well, it is 1858, so I don't know what to say.
This is not like the style at the time. Like this is completely Tarantino just doing this.
Sure.
It is totally off. So they do that, and then they go off to hopefully lead happy lives. Who knows? He did let some people get away, so maybe they'll describe him to the authorities, or and then a bounty hunter comes after him and Django too. But
he's got his wife's freedom papers, and presumably he found his somewhere. They didn't capture those when they killed Schultz, so he'll wander off somewhere, and they'll have a nice life together. He's got Calvin's nice duds and a fresh horse, so he's good.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where it's like, this is not his. I don't think this is my favorite film of his. And this is
what is your favorite film of his? I forget. I'm sure we talked about it in episode one. Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
I will give you this though. The ending of Reservoir Dogs, terrible. Just god awful. Falls off the rails. It just dies in front of you on screen. The first two thirds of that film are very good, but it does not hold up in its totality. But like I said, I'm not really a huge Tarantino fan, so that is my favorite. It should tell you a lot. The other stuff, you know, I just don't his absurdity and his wanting to indulge don't always trigger great feelings within my soul. While I might thematically like, you know, a movie about a hero who rises up against his oppressors, overthrows them, gets his wife back, and then rides off into the sunset, it does have a lot of Tarantinoisms in here that I don't enjoy very much.
Yeah, and I think the reason I was hoping that you would enjoy this one is because I think the nature of the Western film kind of jives with a lot of the Tarantinoisms in this movie. And I'm sure he played some of them up because it is a Western, but I think the, you know, the long, slow dollies and some of the more lingering shots and the snap zooms that he does, which are silly in some places and serious in other places.
The sound effect snap zooms?
Yes, like when he turns around and stares at Steven when they first take Broomhilda out of the hot box. Like, I think a lot of that stuff works with the genre well. If he were to have done these sorts of things in, like, Pulp Fiction or a different time period or setting, I think they would stick out even more. But I think he used them to their benefit in this genre because personally, I am not a fan of Westerns. They bore me to tears in general, but this is 2 hours and 40 minutes of a Western that I can tolerate. And of course it has Tarantino indulgences, but I think that kind of enhances what we're looking at. There is still the problem with this movie that it is three movies stuck together or three episodes stuck together, and it is very long and somewhat disjointed. But, you know, you've got, there's some humor written into the script. There's some pretty well written parts. There's a lot of that, that righteous justice that we like to see on screen. Christoph is great. Of course, he won an Oscar for it, and the script actually won an Oscar as well. But, it's an entertaining movie to watch, and I enjoy watching it from time to time. But I had high hopes for your enjoyment as well, but maybe just landed a little bit below my expectations for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't say I hated it. And I agree that I really like Christoph Waltz. He delivers on his role here as Schultz in such an interesting way that there's sort of an unexpected whimsy almost to the character. Not in a Tim Burton-y kind of way, but like not like a Johnny Depp Captain Sparrow kind of thing, but there are
like a less cloying version of what Johnny Depp is trying to do as Jack Sparrow, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, he has character affectations. He has he has an accent, a way about him, you know. He plays with his mustache. He straightens his coat a certain way. He walks and sits down, you know, and he's very like staccato beats. He has this really interesting quality to him where you want to know more about him. And Jamie Foxx, I think, turns in a great performance as well as the titular Django, who has to both play the uncomfortable role of someone in horrible, despicable conditions, but also rising up against all of this, and he delivers. He doesn't get like the whimsical character moments or anything, but he's not really supposed to. He
gets a couple, yeah. Like with his blue outfit that he picks out for himself, is pretty spectacular.
that outfit. that was something.
You wanted to dress like that?
Yes. That was a good line. But it's interesting. I don't like Westerns either. The notable exceptions to that are I like True Grit, but not enough that I've ever seen it more than once. And I like Tombstone, but I haven't seen that in years, but I used to watch that every now and then when we were in college. One of my roommates had it on DVD.
Does Rango qualify as a Western? Because I love Rango.
I don't know, because that's a lizard. so that's different.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Before I forget, so are you saying that you are glad Jamie Foxx got the role of Django instead of Will Smith?
I did not know that was a possibility.
Will Smith was the original choice for Tarantino, but apparently after meeting and talking about the script for a while, they both decided that it wasn't going to be the best idea for either of them, but he was the first choice.
No. I'm just going to say that right now. No. Jamie Foxx, 1,000 million times better than casting Will Smith for this role. No, definitely not. That would have not been good. I think that would have been a horrible mistake. I think the movie would have not worked at all with him in that role. I think that it works really well with Jamie Foxx. So yeah, mm-hmm. I'm very glad that they talked it over and decided that it wasn't going to work, because I agree. Yeah.
Mm. And this being the as Tarantino tends to do, he found a fan in himself for Christopher Waltz after Inglourious Basterds, which also won Christoph an Oscar, and gave him a bigger role in this one, which I thought was also a wise choice. But did you know that this was a very long shooting for making this movie. I think it said 130 days or something, which is an insanely long period of time. But I know at least a portion of that was used as recovery for Christoph Waltz because he fell off a horse and broke his pelvis in this movie.
Oh my God, ouch.
Yeah. And then somehow managed to come back and finish the movie, which is props for him.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's unfortunate. But yeah, I mean, well, he got an Oscar out of it. So, you know, good job. I'm sorry about your pelvis. It's terrible.
I shouldn't laugh. That is, yeah, that's pretty horrible. Of all the things to break, that makes me just so uncomfortable.
That sounds so excruciating. So let's talk about something else happier. Now that we're done talking about this movie where all these terrible things happen.
Jamie Foxx liked his horse so much that he took it with him after the movie.
Okay. What was the horse's name?
Oh, you're going to make me go back to the trivia page on IMDb.
I'm sorry. You're going to have to work for it. You're going to have to work for our audience, Dan.
Cheetah. His horse's name is Cheetah, apparently.
What? But he's not a cheetah. He's a horse.
It appears that the Jamie Foxx owned the horse before the movie, at least based on the wording of this IMDb trivia.
Oh, so, well, that took a dramatic turn in the span of a few seconds. So he took the horse that he owned on set and used that for his horse in the film, and then took the horse back, and the horse was named Cheetah the whole entire time.
Yes.
Okay. And was that the one that he rode through the majority of the film?
Yes.
Okay. What about Fritz? Does Christoph Waltz own Fritz?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure he's much of a writer these days outside of the film.
Yeah, I can imagine how that might turn someone off of being an equestrian. So that, yeah, that's sad. Again, thanks for going back to the sad place, Dan.
You brought it up. any other thoughts on the movie?
No,
you're not sad that you saw it, right?
No, I'm not sad that I saw it. Mostly because now I can say that I've seen it. Whereas before, it was a movie of some import that people would bring up and talk about, as you did in our very first episode, and I would be unable to offer anything other than, I don't like Tarantino movies, which is just not, you know, a great conversation starter. There's that. It's an improvement, wouldn't you say?
Sure, it's an improvement that you were able to sit through it and you had actually things to say on the matter.
Yes.
Oh, while we're talking about other bits of lore from the movie, evidently when DiCaprio like smashed his fist into the table when they were having that uncomfortable phrenology scene with Ben's skull there, apparently the blood on his hand was actually unintentional because he accidentally slammed his hand on a glass and just kept playing out the scene. So that was nice.
Yikes.
People give it their all in a Tarantino film, evidently.
Wow. Yeah.
Can you imagine a movie like this with ostensibly no visual effects, because it's Tarantino, and I'm sure he said no visual effects, costing $100 million?
There were some visual effects in here.
I'm not sure that there were.
Okay. I know there's some color grading in here. That's for sure.
That is for sure, yeah. All shot 35 anamorphic. But they did have both a film print and a digital print because it's 2012, so can't even call it a print. A DCP was created.
Do you want to tell the audience what a DCP is?
No, digital cinema projection package. Digital cinema package. I don't know what the P stands for.
You need to know what the P stands for, Dan.
Do I?
P is important.
What are we on Sesame Street now?
Freedom, looking for freedom, and to find it cost me everything.
No, Dad, I'm fine. I really did not drink that much kombucha. I'll be okay. I'm down to that part where I drank it so slowly that it started to congeal back towards the bottom.
Why do you buy these beverages?
Live Cultures, Dan. It's got vitamin B6 and B12, and there's a lot of vitamins, Dan, and Live Cultures.
All the great vitamins and cultures.
Yeah, well,
could you just like take a pill or something?
But that wouldn't be as much fun because this is flavored like ginger, and it just goes down so smooth
until it congeals into a solid again.
Well, not really a solid. It's just like strands of yogurt, basically, kind of consistency stuff.
How does that sound appealing?
It doesn't sound appealing. That's why I kind of jiggle it around until the strands break up.
Did you hear how you just described a beverage that you are planning to drink?
Yes. There's strands of live culture in yogurt, Dan. Just think about that. You're eating little lives every time you go to eat your yogurt.
Well, I enjoy the peach flavored ones as well.
Yes.
Peach flavored lives.
Peach flavored murder.
Dial P for murder.